Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics, Iowa style, and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We're glad you're with us. I'm Dennis Hart. Over the past year since we've been on the air with this broadcast, it has originated from a variety of different locations. We have broadcast out of such places as Lake Okoboji, from Gillette, Wyoming, from Three Forks, Montana, not to mention from California and even from Disney World in Orlando. We've been all over. But tonight we break new ground on this broadcast because tonight, my partner in politics on this program, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland, is joining us from her hospital bed. That's right, Laura is in the hospital and she is such a fighter that she insisted on being on Capital Week tonight. Laura, first off, welcome, and how in the world are you feeling?
I feel okay, Dennis. I slipped on the ice on Saturday and broke my ankle, and so I'm in the hospital awaiting surgery, but they've got my pain pretty well under control, and I'm in good hands here, so I am feeling up and ready to talk about Iowa politics.
And we are happy to have you with us, even though I urge you, you know, if you need to take the night off, take the night off, but you said, no, I want to do this. One more quick note before we get into the show. Sammy, your dog, has been on the show barking numerous times over the year, and Sammy played a big role in your being in the hospital.
Yes, well, I can't really blame him. I was walking Sammy, but it wasn't that he pulled at the leash or anything. There was just an icy patch, and, you know, I walk my dog in the winter, and I'm used to navigating carefully over the snow and ice, and I saw this icy patch, and I thought I stepped carefully, but my legs slipped out from under me anyway. So just be careful out there. There's been a lot of melting and refreezing, and it's definitely not the best time to end up in a hospital. The emergency room was pretty crowded on Saturday when I ended up there.
But you're going to be okay. They're going to perform surgery on you later this week, and they say everything's going to come out fine.
Yeah, prognosis is good.
Excellent. And it sounds as if you have a great internet connection tonight compared to last week when you were at home and had some internet trouble. So one might say you went just a little bit too far, Laura, to get a good connection tonight. A little too far.
That's possible. Yeah.
All right. Let's start out with what happened in the U.S. Senate last week. Both of Iowa's Republican U.S. senators voted against a proposed change to the Senate filibuster, and that killed voting rights legislation. Let's talk about that. It was not a surprise.
No, it was expected. I mean, voting rights legislation is not the kind of tax or budget issue that can be done in the Senate with just 51 votes. It requires 60 votes. And it's been known for a long time that there wasn't even really one Republican, let alone 10 Republicans to go along with these votes. But the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer wanted to force the issue a little bit and wanted to get people on the record about how far are they willing to go to secure voting rights in America? And so, as expected, the Republicans in the Senate and two Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, did not support overcoming the filibuster to proceed to debate.
Now, days before the vote, Senator Grassley had said the filibuster, which does require 60 votes to pass most legislation, ensures, as he put it, robust debate and bipartisanship. I think a lot of Democrats would disagree with that.
Yes. I mean, I think originally when the filibuster was used very sparingly, that was the idea. But now that it's become, in the last 15 to 20 years, it's become used so much more frequently, particularly since Barack Obama's presidency, that it doesn't tend to ensure robust debate. It's more the case that it cuts off debate. And by the way, it's not at all unprecedented to have an exception to the filibuster. In fact, just last month, the Senate approved an exception to the filibuster in order to raise the debt ceiling. That was an issue where the Senate Republican caucus didn't want to send the country in default by not having the debt ceiling raised, but they also didn't want 10 of their own senators to go on the record. And so they agreed to a procedural motion that would allow a debt ceiling increase to pass with only 51 votes. So even just in the very recent past, we've seen that senators are sometimes willing to carve out. And of course, when Donald Trump was president, the Senate Republicans, who were then in the majority, they passed a new rule that said that the filibuster doesn't apply to Supreme Court confirmations. So that was another change in the filibuster that just happened within the last few years.
You know, one of the Democrats, one of the Iowa Democrats who hopes to run against Senator Grassley in this year's election, called last week for congressional term limits in Washington. I'm talking about Abby Finkenauer. She pledged to serve just two terms in office if she is elected. That would be 12 years. What do you make of this?
Well, I think, you know, term limits are really a non-starter. It's something that a lot of politicians called for. It would be extremely difficult to amend the Constitution to make that happen. And I think that there are a lot of good arguments against term limits, frankly. But it is, I mean, it was interesting that Senator Chuck Grassley's response to that was that, you know, in theory, he might be supportive of term limits. But since they don't exist, if you having self-imposed term limits just hurts your own state and benefits the other states where people continue to be elected year after year. But I mean, it's kind of on its face a little amusing for somebody who's in serving his seventh term and about to run for his eighth term to say that in principle he supports term limits. And I wonder if that wasn't perhaps part of the strategy of Abby Finkenauer of calling for term limits just to force Senator Grassley into that kind of an untenable position.
Right. Meanwhile, the Democratic National Committee is going to break into the news this coming weekend. They are convening a virtual meeting of their scheduling body on Saturday. Why do we care about this in Iowa? Because one of the things they're likely to talk about is whether Democrats in Iowa get to keep their first in the nation caucuses. So for Democrats in Iowa, this is a big deal.
Yes. And I would say that in the immediate aftermath of Joe Biden's election as president, a lot of people felt that the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary were doomed. Joe Biden did very poorly in both contests, so he doesn't really owe anything to either state. And there are a lot of people within the Democratic Party nationally who feel that the presidential nominating process shouldn't start in two overwhelmingly white states. However, in the last month or two, I've seen more speculation that maybe this is something the Democratic National Committee might not get around to changing the calendar before the 2024 cycle. Maybe it's something that'll be on the books before 2028, but they might have bigger fish to fry. So that'll be interesting to see whether they say, look, you know, the 2024 caucuses on the Democratic side may not be very competitive if Joe Biden runs for reelection, and maybe we can table this discussion until later.
What brought this up again, of course, was the disaster on election night, or on caucus night, rather, in 2020, when Democrats could not count the votes, could not declare a winner on that night. It took weeks for Pete Buttigieg to emerge as the winner over Bernie Sanders, and the Associated Press didn't trust the results at all, so they never called a winner. So that was a mess on that caucus night.
Yeah, there were some real problems, and actually, I mean, there are issues going on right now. Internally, there are some county Democratic Party organizations in Iowa that do not want to hold in-person caucuses. This is the off-year caucuses are much smaller than a regular caucus, but there is still some important party business that takes place, electing people to county committees, for instance, and discussing the platform. And right now, with the COVID situation in Iowa being so bad, a lot of the larger county parties don't want to do an in-person caucus. And so again, it highlights the problem of having a system where you have to be physically in a certain place at a certain time. And many people feel that in the 21st century, there's got to be a way to make it possible for people to participate virtually.
So if you had to crystal ball this, what do you think is going to happen?
I think that I don't think there will be any final decision with the DNC. I'm just curious to see where they're going. I do think that for these upcoming caucuses in February, the off-year caucuses, the Iowa Democratic Party is going to have to make some kind of statement giving county parties the freedom to organize virtual caucuses if they want to do that.
Yeah. Okay, one more note before we get to state politics. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced last week it's going to use more than $800 million from the federal infrastructure bill to improve locks and dams on the upper Mississippi River. Now, Senator Grassley had voted for it. House Republican and congressional incumbent Ashley Hinson of Iowa said in a tweet, "We secured the $829 million," and she called it game-changing. Now, what's quite interesting is that she voted against it.
Yes, and Ashley Hinson, who got a lot of national attention last week, this was written up in the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and it was widely noticed outside her district because there were five members of Congress on that news release announcing the $829 million to modernize a couple of different lock and dams on the upper Mississippi, which is, there are great projects, but Ashley Hinson was the only one on the press release who hadn't actually voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And she stuck to her guns. She and her staff, they said, you know, they felt that the criticism was unfair because they felt that even though she voted against the infrastructure bill, once the funding was on the table, she helped fight for it to come to Iowa as opposed to going to some other states. But I think, you know, the bottom line is if she and most of the House Republicans had had their way, the money never would have been on the table. So, I mean, I'll be curious to see whether this is something that makes her a bit reluctant to take credit for future infrastructure projects that happen in her district, or whether maybe she'll take the same position that she took last week and saying, hey, you know, I'm fighting for these, whether it's roads and bridges or waterways or public transit or airports. There are going to be some pretty significant airport projects, I think, in her district. And so we'll just see what happens.
All right. On the state level last week, word that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds had broken the record for the most cash on hand reported for a campaign for governor. Now, she has not yet announced she's running for re-election, but she's widely expected to do so. She was said to have nearly $5 million cash on hand for the campaign if she runs, and she will run. Now, the previous record was, by the way, Terry Branstad, who had $4.5 million back in 2014. That's one part of the story. An even bigger part is that Democratic gubernatorial candidate Deidre DeGeer, the only one out there actively running against Kim Reynolds right now, reported having $8,500 in her campaign account. So let me repeat that. The governor has nearly $5 million. Deidre DeGeer has nearly about $8,500. Have you ever seen such a fundraising discrepancy at any stage of a campaign?
I haven't. And I mean, everyone knew that Governor Reynolds was going to bring in a very large fundraising report. And by the way, I've never understood this idea about not formally announcing the reelection bid. She's definitely running. She's got several full-time staff. I mean, if you look through her expenditures, she's spending a lot of money on the kind of consulting and staffing that you would do if you're having a campaign. So she's clearly the governor is running for reelection, and I don't really know what the logic is behind not officially being running for reelection. But in any case, yes, having nearly $5 million in the bank going into the election year, that puts her in a very strong position. And I think everyone knew that the Democratic candidate was going to be at a huge fundraising disparity. We saw this even in 2014 when Jack Katch was running. And Terry Branstad was able to outspend him by several times. But this is something that no one's ever seen. $8,500 is a small amount, even for a state legislative candidate in a competitive race. So it's really not, it's just so far below what would be a competitive amount. And honestly, I mean, looking through Deidre DeGeer's spending, I just question whether her campaign can even keep the lights on and keep spending at this rate and even make it through the primary. You know, there are two schools of thought on primaries when you're in the challenger position. You can say, well, it's better just to have one Democratic candidate because they can amass their resources and build up a war chest. Or you can say it's better to have multiple candidates out there making the case against the incumbent and generating some free media. But the Democrats right now are looking at the worst of both worlds because they have a candidate who's barely managing to keep a campaign in the black, and then also not generating the media coverage that you would get if you had Democratic debates or candidate forums or competing interviews, with the Democrats having to be really out there competing against each other for the right to take on Reynolds. So it's really a dire situation for the Democratic Party right now.
And we note that she had, in the campaign money she had raised, what we call a burn rate of 97%. That means that of all the money she got in, she burned 97% of it, used it, leaving her with $8,500. 97% burn rate. Again, I ask you, have you ever heard of that before a campaign starts?
No, and I mean, the fundraising, she raised about $280,000 last year, which, you know, it isn't a terrible amount. But if I go back 4 years to the last gubernatorial campaign, John Norris had raised about $300,000 at this stage in the campaign. And there were four other Democrats who raised substantially more than that. Now, Fred Hubble, you can sort of maybe take Fred Hubble off to the side a little bit because he is so wealthy and had so many people willing to write extremely large checks to him. But Nate Bolton had raised more than $1 million. Kathy Glasson had raised more than $1 million. Andy McGuire, who was running, she had raised about $670,000. So, I mean, part of it is that Kim Reynolds is in a much stronger position now than she was 4 years ago when she was early and she had just become governor less than a year earlier because Terry Branstad had resigned to become ambassador to China. And she seemed a little more vulnerable. And I think that that made it easier to raise money. But it's really, as you say, the burn rate that was just tremendous. I mean, to spend almost all that you're bringing in. And a lot of it was on consulting expenses and salary expenses. And so those, I don't know what kind of contracts the du jour campaign is locked into with some of those consultants, but that was a concern I had looking at the report. If she's on the hook to keep paying these consultants thousands of dollars a month, this is going to be very difficult to sustain, even getting through the June primary. Now, her campaign didn't want to answer detailed questions about the consulting contracts they have. They did say that they don't plan to reduce their paid staff. Right now, they have about 3 full-time paid staffers. And they have a lot of small contributors who are donated online, but what they don't have are the large donors writing the 5-figure checks that Democrats often need just to at least be barely competitive, just to be able to build some kind of semblance of a statewide operation.
It is 16 minutes after the hour, wherever you're listening to us, and you're in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin, who is broadcasting from a hospital room tonight, and she's going to be doing much better and is doing much better. We are here every week at this time, no matter where we are, to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Laura, is it too late, given the tremendous fundraising discrepancy and the fact that, and I think it is a fact, that the du jour campaign is in trouble, is it too late for another Democrat to mount a campaign for governor?
Well, it's getting late for someone to jump in and even just collect enough signatures and build an infrastructure. I know that there are Democrats who have been trying to recruit other candidates to come in. State Representative Chris Hall of Sioux City is someone who has been considering it. I don't know that whether this report makes it more likely or less likely that he would join. But I think that there are quite a few Democrats hoping that they can find some other option, at least to have a competitive primary and to have someone coming out of the primary with a few $100,000 to spend. I mean, Jack Hatch in his 2014 race for governor spent a total of about $1.8 million. That was throughout the whole cycle. It was a lot less than what Terry Branstad spent, but it was something that allowed him to have a statewide operation, to allowed him to run some TV ads. And right now, Democrats are just not in a position to even get the word out about their challenger, let alone make some kind of a case against the incumbent.
So how could this big disparity in money between the governor and du jour help other Republican candidates on the ticket in Iowa? You've written about this.
Yes. Well, some of it depends on what Kim Reynolds does. And of course, I'm not privy to her campaign strategy. But normally my approach when the January 19th fundraising deadline rolls around is I would write separate articles on each of the statewide races so that candidates for Secretary of State, Attorney General, State Auditor, Secretary of Agriculture, a State Treasurer, how much they've raised. And as soon as I looked at those reports for the governor's race, I thought, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that this year because right now, as things stand, Kim Reynolds could turn over millions of dollars to the Republican Party of Iowa and the GOP could turn over millions of dollars to all of these other candidates. So if you look at, for instance, the state auditor race where Rob Sand raised about $900,000 last year, just under that, and has a little more than $900,000 cash on hand, you could say, well, the Republican Marianne Hinoosa, who just announced her campaign in January, so we don't have a fundraising report, you could say, well, she starts out at a bit of a deficit. But if the governor hands over $2 or $3 million for her to spend, I mean, she could be spending at parity. And the secretary of Secretary of Agriculture, Democrats don't even have a declared candidate right now. But Secretary of State, none of the candidates have a lot in the bank. But again, this is a race where Kim Reynolds could make $1 million available to the Republican incumbent, Paul Pate. And for state treasurer, the Republican challenger, Robbie Smith, actually has more cash on hand already. He has about $144,000 cash on hand. Quite a bit of that was money he raised before he announced in December that he was running for treasurer. He's a fairly senior Iowa Senate Republican, and there are a lot of political action committees that just give indiscriminately. They just make lots of donations to everybody who's important in the majority caucus. And so he had a lot of PAC donations before it was known that he was going to be running for treasurer. But this report, certainly, I mean, he has a lead. The incumbent state treasurer, Michael Fitzgerald, only has a little under 50,000 cash on hand. And so that'll be encouraging, I think, to Republican donors who are looking at these races thinking, do our candidates have a chance? And then also, we don't really know what Kim Reynolds would do. I mean, there's no guarantee that she would do that. She could choose to spend her entire war chest on her own campaign. But I think that many people in this situation would turn over a lot of the money to the Republican Party so that they can put it into their own turnout operation. And that's what's so terrifying for Democrats.
You've said in the past on this broadcast that Iowa Attorney General incumbent Tom Miller, Democrat, who's running again for reelection, could be vulnerable against his Republican challenger, Brenna Byrd. Now, Byrd had only about $29,000 in her campaign fund in this last report. Miller had about $150,000. But again, that's where governor's money or GOP money, that can really impact that race.
Yes, and Brenna Byrd, I expected her to be able to run a multi-million dollar campaign anyway, because the Republican Attorneys General Association is very active and they spend a lot of money. They put quite a bit of money into her campaign in 2010, and the Iowa GOP put a lot of money into her campaign in 2010. So the reason why her cash on hand total was very low is because she only just announced that she's running. But I expect that when the next set of deadlines rolls around in May 19th, is when all of these candidates have to declare again, I imagine she'll have well over $1 million in the bank. Wow. I'll be surprised if she doesn't.
Last few minutes, I want to pivot to the coronavirus and its impact on the state legislature as well as the state. In the legislature last week, much of the news revolved around what did not happen. Numerous meetings, as you know, scheduled for the week were canceled. Lawmakers and their staffs not required to disclose positive coronavirus tests. So there's no way to know if the virus was the culprit. But the odds are, yes, the virus is going through the legislature.
Yes, and as we discussed last week, there have been a few known reported positive cases, but legislators and staff are not required to report a positive case. And so we really have no idea how many people have tested positive. I was told by a number of people, and also State Senator Joel Bolcom wrote this in his legislative newsletter, that very few of the lobbyists who crowd together in the rotunda, very few of them are wearing masks. And I don't know if that's because they don't believe in masks or whether they don't want to annoy the Republicans in the majority. Very few of the Republican legislators are wearing masks down there. And so it just seems to be quite a petri dish. And this something that was noticed last Wednesday, that the Iowa House and Senate haven't been doing much business on the floor this early in the session. Their bills are still going into committee and there's not that much floor business, but they still are having short floor sessions every day. And the Iowa House Majority Leader, Matt Winchell, who's the second ranking House Republican, he stood up there on the House floor last Wednesday and apologized for his raspy voice and said, it seems like everybody's getting the Capitol crud right about this time of year. And, you know, I mean, one of the most basic things is stay home when you're sick, right? And he clearly was not well. I don't know, have no idea whether he was tested for COVID or whether he had COVID, but that was just one example of someone who wasn't wearing a mask, was in the House chamber, and clearly wasn't feeling his best.
Well, at least he used a technical term, capital crud.
Yes.
Now the coronavirus around the state. The health department reported 116 more deaths last week from the virus, bringing to 8,317 the number of people who have died in Iowa since the pandemic started. Now, today, Monday, the health department reported nearly 35,000 more new positive tests for the virus. And this after 35,000 on Friday, 36,000 last Wednesday. The numbers just keep getting bad. They just continue to be bad.
Yeah, and the positivity rate of 25%, I mean, that just tells you that even with as many positive cases as we're reporting, we're still not testing enough people, because that just tells you that there are many, many infections not being detected by a COVID test. So the hospitalization number was a little bit lower today, 935, but that's still very high. It's not a level that's sustainable for Iowa hospitals. Really, as we discussed months ago, hospitals were struggling for ICU beds even when the total statewide numbers were in the 500 and 600 ranges. And so to have, this has now been several weeks that hospitalizations have been above 900 statewide, and it's just very tough.
We should also point out that the number of long-term care facilities, pardon me, in Iowa, reporting an outbreak of the coronavirus jumped to 76 today, up from 69 on Friday. It's been a steady rise for weeks. Again, not a good number.
And this is according to the state of Iowa's definition of a nursing home outbreak, which is three or more residents recently testing positive. Some states, including Minnesota, report an outbreak if even one resident or one staff member tested positive. And if we went by those numbers, it's a much higher level of outbreaks. And I just know because I'm following, I have contacts who have loved ones in the Iowa Veterans Home in Washington, or in Marshalltown, rather, and they've been forwarding the notifications from Marshalltown. And they have 14 patients recovering in their COVID unit. That's the largest number that I've seen. You know, periodically when they've had outbreaks in the past, they've tended to have 3, 4, 5, 6 people recovering in their COVID unit. So they are no longer releasing information on whether these people are vaccinated or not. And I'm hoping that maybe many of these cases are breakthrough cases among vaccinated residents and therefore won't be as severe. But that's what they're finding now, is especially with a lot of the elderly in nursing homes, even if they're fully vaccinated but not boosted, they are vulnerable to this Omicron variant. And we can just hope that most of them stay out of the hospital.
Right. And as always, at least as has been the case for months now, most of those hospitalized are not vaccinated.
Right, that is correct. Most hospital, although it is, the percentage is creeping down, so we are seeing slightly higher. Right now, about 30%, just under 30% of the people hospitalized are fully vaccinated.
Let's talk briefly about what did happen in the legislature last week. Senate Republicans advanced a bill called the Second Amendment Preservation Act. It's going to nullify any federal gun regulations that exceed Iowa law. So they are continuing, Republicans who have the power to advance this and pass it, they're continuing to come after any laws against gun ownership or possession.
Well, the two most interesting things about that bill to me were that, first of all, the Iowa Firearms Coalition, which is the state affiliate of the National Rifle Association, they said they're undecided on the bill. And there are questions about, they have questions about the wording of some passages of the bill. So it's not a model bill that was just introduced by the NRA. And so that made me suspicious about whether this would actually accomplish anything. And the other thing is that the lead sponsor on that bill, State Senator Zach Nunn, is running for Congress. He's running in the 3rd District. He's probably favored to win the nomination, although he has a couple of primary opponents in that 3rd District primary. And I saw this as possibly a way for Zach Nunn to try to get in the newspaper, shore up his right flank a little bit. He's not beloved on the right wing of the Republican Party. He was a Jeb Bush endorser before the 2016 Iowa caucuses. And I wondered if this is a way for him to pander to other elements that might not be favorably disposed to his candidacy. Again, the National Rifle Association's affiliate in Iowa is not fully behind this bill yet. They have questions about the wording. So that just made me think that perhaps this legislative proposal isn't really ready for prime time.
Right. A couple of more quickies. The House Human Services Committee took up a 2021 Senate proposal that would change the way the Department of Human Services in Iowa determines, verifies, and tracks eligibility for public assistance programs. So Republicans want to change the number of people who get public assistance, and they want to increase the difficulty of qualifying for it.
Yes, and this is something Senate Republicans have passed several years in a row. It's always died in the House Human Relations Committee before, or Human Resources Committee before. And so the fact that the House committee is thinking about taking up these bills this year, that suggests to me that they're breaking it into several pieces. So maybe not all portions of the package will pass, but it made me think that it's more likely that at least parts of this are going to get to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk.
I have about a minute left. What do you expect to see in the state legislature this week? What's coming up?
Well, I'm always just looking to see which bills get committee hearings. You know, a lot of bills, even ones introduced by Republicans, they may not even get a subcommittee hearing, let alone clear a subcommittee. So I start to look closely at which bills are being assigned to subcommittees, which bills have hearings scheduled on them.
And we know that at some point Republicans are going to take up some kind of education bill or bills, because they are adamant that school districts should change the type of books they have in some libraries that they disagree with in terms of sexuality and other things.
Yes, but there are several competing proposals on that, so I'll be curious to see which one it seems to have legs.
All right. Well, Laura, that's a fun way to end the show, because you're on one leg right now. You are broadcasting. If you just tuned into us, you are a fighter. You are in the hospital because of a broken ankle. You've been broadcasting from your hospital room. Laura, as I told you over the past weekend, you are amazing. You have gone above and beyond any call of duty to be here. Thank you so much, and you get better, okay?
Thank you, Dennis. I'll be back next week.
I have no doubt about that. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will zoom right back here in this time slot next week. Who knows where we're broadcasting from, but we'll be here, and who knows what we're going to say. But tune in, and we will have the latest on what's going on politically inside and outside the state capitol. Until now and then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it. We value it. And we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy week. That includes you, Laura.